Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hey Jay, how's it going?
It's going good, Mike. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. You had a good week?
Well, pretty good. I'm sore today. I was skiing most of the day yesterday, which of course that's what we Republicans do when we can't be yachting.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So
this is the weather for it.
Yeah, I know. It was like the first not super, you know, sub-zero wind chills. We were able to get out, and I think I sort of overdid it. So I'm recovering quietly in my wood-paneled study
as
we discuss the week's events.
You know, at that age where overdoing it can be an occupational hazard of life, I suppose.
Yep.
So it was an interesting week for me. I actually had the entire week off. So it was sort of an early spring break from my work, Northern Kentucky University.
Due to global warming, I would suppose. You had the week off for climate change.
Yes, we had the week off due to climate change. First it was snow, then it was cold, and one thing led to another, and I was able to stay at home all week. So,
That must be nice.
I was advocating all week, actually, for NKU to close for the children, really.
Right.
That was my concern about the children.
It is all about the children.
I think it's very important because I do believe they are, in fact, our future, and that isn't a Bobby Christina Brown.
I couldn't agree more, yes.
Anything. So, what's been going on in politics this week that you'd like to talk about?
Well, you know, the big thing for me has been discussion of ISIS, and I feel like we're finally sort of getting serious about this in terms of the national conversation, and you know it kills me to say things like national conversation.
Oh, it should.
But there was a piece in The Atlantic that came out this week,
and
you know, The Atlantic is not Fox News, it's not National Review, it's not any of the various, red state type
like
websites.
Red State, sure.
Yeah, for example, Red State. And it was a very lengthy piece, and it's discussing about the ideology and the religious tenets of ISIS, and sort of asked the question, is ISIS Islamic? And the conclusion is, yeah, they're pretty damn Islamic.
Mm-hmm. Old school.
Yeah,
in fact.
That's exactly
the point. They're the real hardcore sort of Islamic people.
Yeah, and I want to sort of counter that or compare that with the increasingly bizarre statements coming from the Obama administration that look, this isn't Islam, this isn't, you know, and so forth, which is it seems to be strange, and as the article would point out, it seems to be counterproductive, because to really, if we're going to put together a strategy against these folks, we need to understand what it is they're after and where they're coming from.
Right, and it seemed to me in my reading of the article, what they're after is they sort of like to kill all of us.
Yeah.
So there's that.
That's the sort of troubling thing, and the Atlantic article points out this is much different than a Al-Qaeda or other terrorist threats that we've faced before, in that core to this belief system, which, I mean, they tie directly to their reading of the Quran, is that in the end times, there's going to be an Islamic caliphate, which is necessarily sort of a state-type entity that controls territory.
Mm-hmm.
So it's much different than the Al-Qaeda model. You have sort of cells of terrorists who just go and blow stuff up.
Him. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
right.
Generally. You naturally can have control. And according to their belief system, once you have this state, then there sort of becomes an obligation to start doing things like beheading apostates.
Right, and crucifixions, they mentioned
yeah.
that. That's a,
and slavery and all these things. All these things sort of become permitted. And it's tied to the fact that you're holding territory. And I think that's a key thing that militarily makes a difference.
Mm-hmm.
And why we need to think of ISIS differently than we think of other terrorists. And also why we need to look at what are the Islamic beliefs that they're following.
Right. And I think it goes back to that, and a number of folks have pointed this out. It goes back to that assumption, that often mistaken assumption that we make, that other people think exactly the same way we do, in kind
right.
of a Western secular sort of way. And it never occurs to a lot of people, at least, that they might actually be serious about their religion.
There's sort of the idea in the West so often that when countries, states, or even individual groups go out and do something violent, so forth, and then chalk it up to some other reason, that they're being somehow insincere.
Right.
No, this isn't really about religion. It's about grabbing territory. No, it's not. It's, you know, it's about money. It's about, but no, these guys, it's about religion.
But I think in a way, it's sort of, my take at least, is it's sort of a false dichotomy. At least it can be. I mean, I think the people who say that it's, you know, all about unemployment and oppression and colonialism, I think that's just flat out wrong. But I also think that they have at least a little bit of a point, where people who are in those sort of situations, you know, they're idle, they have nothing to do, they're disgruntled, maybe they're more receptive to
a message. I would agree. And I was going to say, I would actually, I don't want to say I'm going to defend Marie Harf, as if our listeners are probably familiar, the really cute blonde State Department spokesperson.
Wears glasses very well.
Yeah, she does.
It's important. We'll post a picture.
I think we ought to have sort of a ladies of the State Department, or now the White House.
Wow, that's sexist. That's an idea.
Well, I know it is. It is.
That would be fitting coming from the right. Okay.
I've got some. Yeah, you know how I am. She of course made the statements that. And I want to go back to all that she said. She didn't just say that ISIS needs jobs, but she started by saying, you know, you can't win a war. You don't win a war by killing people.
I think you do.
But you've been in a war.
I didn't kill anyone, but I'm pretty sure that was sort
what
of
you
the
want.
Point. we did.
But
we did win.
I
like to think I played no small part in that. You know.
Yeah. And actually, ironically, Patton was on Turner Classic Movies last night, and sort of the statement about, you know, no poor son of a bitch ever won a war by dying for his country. The point is to make the other poor son of a bitch die for his.
This is why we have wars.
Yeah. And it's tantamount to saying, you know, you don't win a football game by scoring points.
Yeah,
and so
exactly. On. It's a ridiculous statement.
But she made that statement and then followed up saying, yes, we can't kill our way out of this war. And you need to go back to the root causes. Now, And the funny thing was, it was Chris Matthews who even sort of tried to rein her in a little
bit.
Wow,
really?
You know, and say, look, Marie, come on, you really want to go? And she was all in. But look, I'll defend her on the extent that you say, to some extent, people who are unemployed are discriminated against, are sort of lost, tend to be more fertile ground for
sure.
extremist ideology. But by the same token, if you look at these folks, religion is the biggest part of it. And however they got there, however they were the fertile ground, the ideology is what matters.
Exactly. I mean, I think there are two parts of it. One is trying to disrupt the recruitment and the pipeline. And so there may be some of the economic type things might have some sort of an effect. But once you get people who are committed to this ideology, giving them a good job at Walmart or something like that, that's not going to cut it.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so we're dealing with, I think, two distinct problems. And it's pretty clear, at least to me, that we don't really have any great options here But certainly, at least in the article, the argument was in part that this group, even though they are a lot more dramatic, certainly, and some of the things they do are a lot more unsettling, they actually maybe pose less of a threat to the United States than Al-Qaeda did, or does.
At least initially.
At least initially, because they're focusing more on their backyard, essentially,
right.
Where Al-Qaeda wanted to, you know, well, we know what Al-Qaeda wanted to do because they did some of it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, no, it's more about, securing their own territory first. And what's interesting in the article, too, there's a discussion about other Islamic fundamentalist-type groups who we look at as, you know, might be a competition for ISIS, who believe that the time for the caliphate is not now, which is a little unsettling because these folks are sort of like, look, we're really not on board with the beheadings just yet.
Right. But, yeah, give it a little time. Yeah, it's, yeah.
But, you know, it may be our choices are bad and worse.
Yeah, I think so. But
and beheading tomorrow beats a beheading today.
Absolutely. And so, I mean, a lot of folks have pointed out that President Obama has criticized President Obama for not being willing to use the phrase Islamic terrorism or Muslim terrorism or something like that. And he just calls
Islamic extremism is what we'd like him to say.
Exactly. So, and I think there's a pretty obvious reason why he doesn't want to say it is because there are a lot of people who in the United States who don't like that term and he'd rather not piss them off. I think he knows. I think it's ridiculous to argue that he doesn't believe that this is Islamic extremism or Muslim extremism. Of course he knows that, but he doesn't see any political advantage to saying it.
See, I don't even know. I'm almost a little bit concerned that he really does believe that it's not an Islamic extremism, that he really sees this as, or he sees extremism as any sort of religious fundamentalism,
so,
for, you know, to the extent that, yeah, he compares it with the Crusades and so forth.
So I give Obama more credit for duplicity, and you give him more credit for I give him more credit for duplicity. You give him more credit for intelligence, maybe, or lack of intelligence.
No, I would say for being honestly insane.
Honestly insane. Okay, all right. Well,
I guess that's the good way to put it.
Yeah, I think he knows what's going on, and it's just one in a series of political moves. But anyway, so clearly not many very. Very good options in this area, that's
no,
for sure.
But I would recommend to all of our listeners to go back and read that Atlantic article because I do think it's one of the few of the times where you say, hey, this is an important article.
Yes.
That really change how people think about things.
Yeah,
so.
I'll make sure that goes up in the show notes. So.
Well, okay. What else? Yeah. Hello?
Yeah, okay. So there we had a momentary technical difficulty, but we're back. I'm sure no one was terribly upset, I hope, but we are back. So anyways, moving on from ISIS, I wanted to kind of come back to the domestic front. And there's some big news in the U.S. On Thursday, Walmart announced that they would be increasing wages for about half
that.
A million of their employees.
Now, let me get this straight, Mike. Did the government tell them they had to increase wages, or did
no,
they
Jay,
just decide
no,
to do this?
No, the government did not. They did that their very own selves.
Huh.
It does happen, yeah. and the details are that by this time next year, the minimum wage for all their employees will be at least $10 an hour.
Okay.
And so the big question, of course, was, well, why are they doing this?
And why do you think they're doing it?
Well, I think they're doing it because there are, I think, at least two reasons. There might even be three, which probably means there are at least half a dozen. But
right.
The main reasons are, number one, the labor market's tightening. You know, a few years ago, unemployment was closer to 10%, 9-10%. Now it's right around 5%, which is at a level we sometimes call full employment, which is about as low as it gets with people going back and forth between jobs and so forth. So when you get a tightening labor market, employers have to pay more for people.
Although I do think, just before you go forward, I would put an asterisk by that unemployment number. Just based on the workforce
participation rates.
Yes. Yeah. So, go on.
Yeah, and so meaning that fewer people are actually looking for jobs, and in part that might be because we have more older people who are retiring, but part of it isn't that at all. Part of it's what are called discouraged workers. And that's a good point. But I think a related reason is that Walmart, and this is kind of tied into this, which is why I used the word related reason, is that Walmart is having trouble keeping people. And so, you know, job training costs, you wouldn't think that it takes a lot of job training to qualify to work at Walmart. And okay, it's not like being, you know, a nuclear engineer or something like that, but it still does require some time and effort in training. And, you know, that there's a lot of churn. And so Walmart would like to not train people and then lose them. And you pay people a little bit more and they're a little more interested in sticking around. And so I think that's part of it as well.
Okay.
And I think a third thing is that Walmart's kind of seen where minimum wage laws are in the states, and there are a number of states where they're talking about raising it or there are minimum wage increases that will be going to effect. And since we're going to have to already raise their minimum wages in those states, they might as well announce it preemptively and get some good press for it.
Well, and not only that, it sort of takes the wind out of the sails, to use one of my Republican yachting terms, of the folks who would push for minimum wage.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I think there would be an argument if you're Walmart that even if minimum wage you increase and the minimum wage ratchets up, there is still going to be then another ratcheting effect.
Right, right.
Here's what I would say. I mean, my very succinct response to all that would be, God bless America.
the market works is the,
exactly.
I think the Republican response to that. Yeah.
Yeah. The free market works. And I do agree, as someone who's worked, I've worked in the public sector and worked in the private sector, the public sector, it does make a big difference, churn rate.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because there are lots of expenses that go into hiring and terminating employees. Yeah. And you don't always, you know, most folks don't realize it, but yes, it's huge, from the advertising of jobs to interviewing to training. That's all time you're taking away from something else that someone else might be doing.
I think on this point, I have a story for you.
Oh, okay. What's that?
It's a story that a lot of people have heard, but a lot of people have misinterpreted. Back a little over 100 years ago, actually, so it's like history as well as a story. In 1913, Henry Ford needed a workforce of around 14,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
To get that workforce at the prevailing wage in the auto industry, which was then around $2.35 a day, he had to hire over 52,000 people just to keep a workforce of around 14,000.
Okay.
So that's a tremendous amount of churn.
Yeah.
And so what Henry Ford did in 1914 is he nearly doubled the prevailing wage. He offered a $5 a day wage for assembly line workers. And what happened? His churn rate went way down.
Now, and his sales went up because he was then able to sell his own products to his workers.
Yeah. And now that second part, see, that's the part that the left tends to focus on a lot. And that's actually not – that's sort of the part of the story that's not as true, at least, in that the reason he did it wasn't that he thought he could somehow cannibalize his own profits so he could sell more cars to his own workers. It, as a matter of economics,
cannibalize
it doesn't work out too well.
Wow.
Yeah. But,
sounds ugly.
But he did it because it made good business sense, because of the cost of hiring and training workers. So that, I think, is, you know, really important and something that's often overlooked. So Walmart didn't do this to, you know, do something for the middle class or the lower middle class. Walmart's spending like $1 billion on this. And the idea that some people suggested that anti-Walmart protests have had anything to do with this or anything more than an insignificant amount is just, I think, silly. Protests don't work that well, certainly not for a company as big as Walmart. So they're doing it because it's a good business move for them.
Right. And to me, I would say that's absolutely wonderful, because it's exactly what businesses ought to do.
Absolutely.
The idea that a business would say we want to do something because it's good for the middle class or something else.
Yeah.
I find troubling.
Oh, don't even get me started.
Because they also have to do something that's good for all the millions of stock owners of Walmart, mm-hmm. And all the little old ladies who have Walmart securities that are somehow in a pension or in a mutual fund and so forth.
The idea that businesses have some sort of a social responsibility is, I think, just ridiculous. Publicly traded companies, anyway. But,
well, good. That's refreshing to hear coming from you. So
definitely good economic news and a happy thing for, like I said, around 500,000 Walmart employees. So it's nice to talk about some good news every once in a while, but I think we don't want to, you know, get too much into that. So let's talk about something a little more contentious. Immigration has been in the news lately, right?
This would make it a little tougher for a lot of folks who are now illegal immigrants, and I'll use that term because – as the judge who wrote the opinion, that's the term that you use. If you have folks who are here in violation of federal law, which reminds me of the Simpsons episode of immigration. Do you ever see that one?
I don't think so.
And Mo ends up getting deported.
Gosh, that sounds good.
And Marge, you know, he was an illegal immigrant, and Marge Simpson notes that Mo's getting sent off on the boat. His only crime was violating U.S. law.
Oh, Mo.
This, of course, it has to do with the executive order, which, interestingly, the judge, this is District Court Judge Andrew Kanan out of Texas, points out there was really ever an executive order. Did you know that?
Well, why don't you kind of explain that briefly?
Well, you know, typically an executive order is something that's actually issued by the White House, by the executive, and says here is policy as to this, you know, whatever the topic happens to be. This, instead of being an executive order signed by the president, was actually sort of a memorandum that came from Secretary of Homeland Security Jay Johnson regarding internal running of the Department of Homeland Security. Now, again, the difference is sort of academic, but I'm interested in academic legal stuff, that's why I just thought it was kind of funny. And if our listeners want to let, you know, some smart to other people, they can, of course, raise that, well, it wasn't really an executive order.
Well, if I understand it correctly, though, this ruling had nothing to do, really, with the Constitution. It was really about the fact that the Obama administration did not follow the provisions of something called the Administrative Procedures Act, that calls for, if you're going to make a change to administrative procedures, you need to post a notice and allow people to comment, and there's a procedure, as the name would suggest, before you can actually implement it.
Right. And it's the, you know, of course, this is not the final decision. This came up on a preliminary injunction, which there were the plaintiffs in this case, which are a consortium of states, 26 of them, challenged the implications of the Jay Johnson rules, saying, exactly that. Yes, these can't go into effect. One, because it's violating the APA. A preliminary injunction, if anyone wants to know this. The thing you have to show is, one, you're likely to succeed on the merits at the end of the day. Two, there's going to be irreparable harm if this something that's going to happen is not enjoined.
Yeah, yeah.
Three, that it's sort of equitable to all parties. Mm-hmm. And there's a fourth. Well, I won't get into all that. Anyway, what the judge said was, first of all, there was a standing question. They said, yes, the states have standing because they're going to be called upon to do other administrative services for these immigrants. Once it got over that hurdle,
right?
The court says, you know, here's the problem. It's not a question of prosecutorial discretion, which is how the Obama administration has decided it or described it.
And just to be clear on that, I think the idea there is that they're not changing the law. At least their argument is they're not changing the law. They're just deciding not to, not so much not to enforce it, but just to sort of delay enforcing it.
Well, sort of. The idea is that if you're a prosecutor or sort of probably any executive, you have a right to sort of prioritize those things that you do within the confines of your budget and the availability and the importance of the certain actions to the public. The judge said, listen, if you're talking about prosecutorial discretion and simply prioritizing which immigrants you go after, isn't that what the government's been doing for years now?
Yeah, and it's prosecutorial discretion is one thing, but an actual formal policy that says you can apply for a program that will delay you from being deported for multiple years,
yes,
that sounds a lot more like changing the law.
And that's exactly what the court said. That listen, it's one thing just to say we're going to leave these folks alone. It's quite another to say we're going to create a process whereby they can become documented and have a legal status here. And that does go beyond simply just that, and it keys into the APA. So I mean, my sense is I think the court got it right.
So what happens now?
Well, what happens now is the Obama administration is appealing this preliminary injunction to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. My sense is it's probably a losing fight there. One, I'm not positive that they even have what's called a final appealable order. Typically, preliminary injunctions are not appealable. Mm-hmm. The courts, you know, say, look, we'll hash this all out once it's
right.
done, but we're not going to step in right now. Second, the whole point of the preliminary injunction is to preserve the status quo.
Mm-hmm.
And the status quo is, it is what it is.
Right.
We're not issuing these things. So for that reason, I would say he's unlikely to succeed on appeal. And the third reason, it's the Fifth Circuit, which tends to be more conservative. You know, you can never say for sure what a court's going to do.
Right.
And also, I would say appellate courts on an issue of like a preliminary injunction will tend to be more deferential to the
right.
Trial court.
Because it's not the final decision, and like you said, it preserves the status quo and so
exactly.
forth. So, yeah, absolutely, that makes sense. So this is certainly an ongoing thing. The Obama administration was not happy in their statement. They said that the district court's decision wrongly prevents these lawful, common-sense policies from taking effect, at which point I blew a gasket. The word common sense in political discourse is one of those things that always just sets me off.
Right.
If I hear that word, I just think you are full of it, essentially, because
right.
it basically is just a subtle way of accusing your opponents of having no common sense.
Well, and I would, you know, what troubles me a little bit more is that it's kind of duplicitous. Because, and the judge points this out, the policies themselves are not particularly at issue.
Right.
What's at issue is the procedure
right.
by which they were put in place.
Yeah, and so one would think that the Obama administration could presumably issue this policy through the Administrative Procedure Act approved method, and then that would take away that objection of the judge.
Well, maybe not. I think it raises a different question. I think there's still going to be the core question of is this something that can be done administratively as opposed to congressional action?
So it could be enjoined, but then it would be enjoined on different grounds.
Different reason, exactly.
Yeah. So, all right. So I'm sure that we have not heard the end of this, that's for sure.
No.
Okay, moving on. You know, we were talking about earlier the Obama administration response to ISIS, and one person who's had a lot to say about that recently is former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani. I'm sure you've heard of that, right, Jay?
I've heard of that, yeah.
He was at a...
You can take the boy out of New York, but you can't take
there
New
you
York
go.
Out of
yeah.
there, I think.
In fact, he was in New York at a Scott Walker rally on Wednesday night, and he said, among other things, that President Obama does not love America.
Well, and I'll tell you, Mike, I'll let you go first on this, because I want to know what you think of that. First of all, sort of on the is that out of bounds fair statement, but then also on the merits.
Well, I think it suggests that Rudy Giuliani has an insight into President Obama's soul that's really impressive. I didn't even know they were friendly. So I really just think it was a former politician who makes quite a bit of money being, speaking to right of center groups, just seizing the moment to raise his brand image and the possibility of making a little more money. I think that's the main part. The other part is I do think he is legitimately upset about President Obama's policy in the Middle East, and understandably so. But I think it was essentially a cheap shot that was done for more than anything else for publicity purposes.
I don't know if it was necessarily done for publicity purposes. I mean, it was done at a private fundraiser, as I understand.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Scott Walker described it as sort of, hey, we're in New York. Sort of a,
what's Rudy
a Giuliani or, sure. Hey, screw you. Right. New York-y right. kind of response.
Sure.
But on the merits, what do you think about that? Do you think Obama loves America?
I don't have any reason to think that he doesn't, but I think it's a ridiculous question. I honestly don't care if President Obama loves America. What I care is if he does a competent job and he's accountable to the voters.
Okay.
And so he could hate America. He could have an evil plot. To me, that's a red herring.
Well, I'll tell you, this is something that I thought about a little bit. And first of all, is it politically out of bounds to say something like that, or you can't question someone's patriotism? I think, well, of course you can.
Sure, why not?
And lots of times you ought to. And Obama certainly did that to his predecessor. And, he accused Mitt Romney of murdering people.
that's pretty serious.
But what I think is Giuliani misses, or maybe whether he's that, it strikes me almost is that I don't know so much as whether Obama loves America or doesn't love America.
He likes it, but does he like it?
Exactly.
You know?
Does he even like America?
I think it's a silly question.
But it's a silly question because I think you can look back at George Bush, you could look at Bill Clinton, and you could look at another variety of our presidents and say, yeah, they like America. They like what this is about. They like.
Oh, and we can say that because, of course, we know who they are when the cameras. I mean, it's all just image and posturing and so forth. And that whole patriotism argument, I think, is just bullshit. I really do.
But Obama doesn't even pretend to like America.
I think that's absolutely wrong. I think he definitely pretends to like America. But I think his presentation, the way he presents himself to the world, is just much more cerebral, and a lot of people don't like that. A lot of people like to see something more emotional, whether it's a George W. Bush type thing or whether it's a Bill Clinton type of thing. And so I think that just doesn't play well with some people. But does that mean he doesn't love America? Who the hell knows? Sure, well, Rudy Giuliani.
Remember Michelle Obama saying on multiple occasions, the first time she's ever been proud of America was when her husband was nominated for the presidency. That's a pretty high bar.
She's not the president. She's not the president. She's the president's wife.
My husband was nominated president.
So that may have a serious effect on her. What is she doing? Like getting people to grow vegetables and eat arugula or something? Whatever. I don't know. But.
But no, I think the whole Obama thing is there's always just been this sense that, you feel like he's just terribly disappointed in all of this.
See, I don't get that at all. But
really?
Maybe that's because we're coming at this from two very different ideological viewpoints. Not very different, but different, certainly.
Yeah. I mean, I get the feeling like, if Obama were to go to the Olympics and watch a soccer game of the U.S. versus, I don't know, like Costa Rica, who do you think he'd root for? You know what I mean?
I totally disagree with you. I think your right wing prejudices are just infecting you on this, whereas I am completely unbiased in my estimation of President Obama.
We'll see. I think we all sort of keep a running tab of things where I sense that Obama doesn't like America. And again, I'm not going to say doesn't love America.
But he can love it, but not like it.
He's just a little embarrassed by the whole thing. You know what I mean?
Now, they'll see there. I think, and I think that that highlights an important difference oftentimes between liberals and conservatives, in that the more traditional conservative or liberal view, I'm sorry, would be that, you know, a love of country, but an appreciation that the United States is flawed, in some cases has been deeply flawed. And I think liberals have a tendency to focus more on those flaws than conservatives do.
I think that's right. Yeah.
And so I think it's healthy to have both of those.
Right.
You know, as kind of a balancing, that sort of uncritical love it or leave it type of view that some extreme conservatives hold, I think is unhealthy and ridiculous. Just as I think that that sort of uncritical America is evil.
The sort of Howard Zinn approach to history.
Is, I think that's ridiculous as well. So anyway, and I don't think Obama has either of those approaches. I think he's somewhere in the middle. But as a liberal, yeah, I think I would agree that he is more focused on what he sees as the flaws in America than, say, someone like Rudy Giuliani.
Yeah. No, I think we'd be in agreement there.
Anyway.
But, one thing else I think we can agree on, and I want to mention this just in passing, is, you know, we talked about Marie Harf earlier making the sort of ridiculous jobs for ISIS sort of argument.
Right.
The other, my favorite State Department crush, Jen Psaki, is going to be going to the White House communications staff.
It's almost as if there's some sort of a physical appearance sort of guideline or profile that they have for spokespersons, spokespeople.
Well, in one sense, I'd say that's in some ways that's maybe kind of good, because that's what the private sector does, right? I mean, you know, the whole idea is you want attractive people out there representing whatever your product is. Before the, I'm trying to think of the prior State Department spokesperson, Karen, I'm blanking on her last name. She was an older woman, sort of matronly. But you know. Yeah, when people got up and said something, you know, we were serious. The sense with Jen and Marie is you know, they're sort of saying that, listen, some not all of the sorority sisters have RSVP'd to the formal,
and
there's going to be trouble if they don't.
It sounds like a critique of Fox News as well, sort of an extension.
But, of course, Fox News is a private news organization who, and I think I would say most all news people like to put good-looking people out there, whereas this is the government spokespeople. But let me just, I just want to point out, first of all, and I don't know if this is appropriate to say, but, you know, it's our show and we'll say
it
or not. But,
we decide what's appropriate.
Yeah. But I will certainly miss seeing Jen Psaki around. Just because she's absolutely adorable, and I got a crush on her, and you know, it's probably, you know, it would probably never work out.
Well, you don't know. You don't know.
Well, and, you know, and I sort of thought about this. Yeah, she would obviously be a, you know, being that I'm married, I'm not sure what her marital status is, and
yeah, you might want to
like
flip
it off. Because, you know, Dan, if you're listening, I'm not like, you know, a stalker. It's
good to know.
But sure. I would expect that, you know, working for Kerry and now the Obama administration, she'd have sort of liberal progressive views to on relationships, and would probably view a lot of the rules that go with marriage as just part of the patriarchy.
Okay.
So
this is all good to know.
So what I'm sort of saying is if Jen Psaki you know, doesn't hook up with me, the patriarchy wins.
Well, that's food for thought, really.
So, but anyway, no, I you know, my feelings towards her, and this is something that just drives me nuts, is it's almost like, you know, the girl, like, you knew in college who, she was really cute and really nice, but she was just going out with a really jerk boyfriend.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And a guy who treated her badly, and, you know, would make her go up in front of crowds of people and say absolutely ridiculous things. You know, that's just
having flashbacks, but yes, go ahead.
You know, would feel like, wow, you know, I could just treat her so much better. But anyway, that's my thing. And I want to say congratulations to Jen to going to the White House. I hope she still gets plenty of screen time.
Definitely.
because I'm completely shallow on those things.
As you were talking, I could almost picture the John Hughes movie that would be made out of, you know, between you and Jen Psaki.
Well, you know what? Maybe that's it, because she does a sort of like a Molly Ringwald kind of.
Oh, well, there you go. See, she hit that
the redhead kind of.
Yeah, that could be it. That could be
maybe
it.
That's why I'm getting sort of flashbacks. But,
Jen,
anyway,
Jen,
I do want to say that I think it's, you know, a lot of conservatives have sort of taken a hatchet to Jen and Murray. And I feel maybe a little unfairly because they're spokespeople and they're just out there saying what they're told to say.
Yeah,
I have on occasion been in positions where I have to represent positions that are not as strong as I would like them to be. Maybe have to make some sort of statements that I know, geez, this sounds sort of ridiculous, but you got what you got, and you've got to serve your clients. So anyway, congratulations, Jen, and you know, if you're listening, you know where to find me. So anyway, that's what else you got?
I think one final thing, I think we still have time for it, is this last week, the American Political Science Association, my people, came out with a new ranking of U.S. presidents. And you can probably, I bet you could probably guess, let's try the top five. Who would you say?
All right. I would say, I mean, Lincoln always scores well in these things.
One for one. Very good, Lincoln.
I would say Franklin Roosevelt always scores well.
Yeah, but he came in third.
Okay. I would say, it's probably Washington.
Yeah, Washington. Lincoln and Washington have been kind of a traditional 1-2. So you got Lincoln, Washington, Roosevelt.
I would say Andrew Jackson.
Oh, you're kind of getting down there, but let me help you out a little bit.
And then of course Clinton and Obama.
In the most recent poll, it was Lincoln followed by Washington, then the two Roosevelts, Franklin and Theodore, and at number five, Thomas Jefferson.
Okay.
And some discussion about this earlier, I'd read that did the guy who did sculpted Mount Rushmore get it right?
Right.
And
you mean on the merits of the people?
Yeah, they look pretty much exactly like
it really does look like Lincoln.
Yeah, it was very impressive, especially working, you know, in that medium. But no, were they actually the four best presidents? And of course, the presidents on Mount Rushmore are Lincoln, Washington, Theodore Roosevelt, and Jefferson.
Right.
And the conclusion of this, therefore, was that, well, they got it mostly right. And that FDR, if we were going to make a modern Mount Rushmore, you would just replace Jefferson with FDR.
Oh, that sounds terrible.
I think that's a wonderful idea. Thomas Jefferson was an awful human being, a horrific man, an amazing hypocrite. He makes my skin crawl. I hate Jefferson. I wish Hamilton just would have.
Those are personal attacks.
They are
ad hominem there. An actual issue here with
Washington hated him.
Both Washington hated him.
Washington hated him. Oh, my God. And Adams hated him. And everyone hated him because he was a hateful, awful man. He shouldn't be on Mount Rushmore. If I could, I would go up there today with a jackhammer and take him off of Mount Rushmore. Thomas Jefferson, awful, awful human being.
Let me put it this way. If it hadn't been for Thomas Jefferson, Mount Rushmore would be in France. I think that's something else to think about.
Now, I'm not saying that Thomas Jefferson didn't do some good things. I'm just saying he was an awful human being. That's all. So, yay, Louisiana Purchase. I get it. That's wonderful. But he was an awful person. And I would so rather see a couple of Roosevelts up there than Thomas Jefferson. Anyway, that's just
and me. Well, I would also point out Jefferson was the guy who helped insist that we have a Bill of Rights in our Constitution that is modeled on Virginia's Bill of Rights, with the freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom to the press, Fifth Amendment rights, all those things which we see as the cornerstones of American liberty. Were things that were put in by Jefferson. And I would point out we'll have to talk about this sometime, but those ideas, those limitations, It's something we think that it's a big part of America, but it's almost like if we don't have that, that's the first thing that, that a government will take.
Well, and
so that's why I say Jefferson stay up there. If I had to take somebody down, it would probably be Teddy Roosevelt.
Oh, yeah, wrong. Like, you're so wrong. He's my favorite president. In fact, I'm staring at a TR bust right now. I have a little bit of thing for Teddy Roosevelt.
Well, again, are you going on personal, cool guys would be cool to have a beer with, or you are saying as what they did as president?
I'm saying what he did. I'm saying you cannot find a better, more impressive non-wartime president than Teddy Roosevelt. That's what I'm saying.
I'll have to think on that a little bit.
So many reasons. But anyway.
Better than Reagan?
Much better than Reagan.
Reagan,
seriously overrated. Not as overrated as, say, Wilson, but overrated.
Right. No, I would argue Wilson is an absolutely horrible human being.
Well, yeah, exactly.
There's a horrible human being.
Incredibly overrated as a president, too. Yeah. Well, it's nice to say that we could end on something we agree on, that Woodrow Wilson, bad guy, bad president.
Yep.
All right.
Don't put him up anywhere.
No, he definitely shouldn't be on anything, for sure. All right, well, I think that wraps it up for this week. So we will see you again next week for our next exciting, action-packed episode of The Politics Guys. And so I will see you then, Jay.
All right. See you then.
Great. Bye-bye. Take care.